Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 30th of September 2012. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Nick from Partially Obstructed View, Gareth James, Web Cowgirl, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about This House, which is a new play by James Graham, which I think is sold out at the Cottesloe Theatre, and probably deserves to be. It's a rather odd piece on the face of it. It is about the sort of the backstage life of the House of Commons between, what is it, February 1974, when Labour won a very closely contested election, and 1979 when they finally lost power. After just over 5 years, although it's there is a bet that takes place, but that's after the October 1974 election, where Labour went from a minority power to which the minority government that they had in February to a very narrow majority. And this is really the tale of the Labour Party trying to defend that majority and how they did it for the 5 years or the 4.5 years between 1974 and 1979. And it's a fascinating piece, really, and very well done. What we see the world through the lives of a group of Labour and Tory whips, and also a number of other MPs. We are sat in the theatre as if we are sitting in the House of Commons. There's approximately the same length, the same set out of the bench seats, and the famous two sword lengths apart. I'm not sure if we were actually two sword lengths apart. I didn't have my sword with me, but it's a really nice feel to it. The way that James Graham's done this is that he says in the programme that he's fictionalised a lot of the things, but he does name several people. So you have the main group of Labour whips are all named, and the Tory whips are, and so we have five Labour whips who are all given names, and these are real people who really existed, and he was able to interview quite a lot of them. And you also have a group of Tory whips who, again, he was able to, well, maybe not talk to all of them, but he was able to, you know, research them. And although he says, you know, pretty much all of a lot of this stuff happens behind closed doors, they've also, you know, written biographies and people have told them, so he's got quite a good picture of what happens, and it's very believable. The other members of Parliament are referred to usually only by their constituency name, so you'll get people called out as the MP for Peebles. Now, the way they do this is they have a character playing the Speaker, and the Speaker will introduce the person doing it. But, I mean, the play here is very, really fascinating for its politics. This is something I slightly remember. I was getting very interested. I was only barely a teenager by 1979, but I remember the politics of this, and I remember many of the things happening. What I didn't quite realise, and haven't quite realised, is how almost impossible this tiny majority that they had to defend for 4.5 years, how almost impossible it made them to actually legislate. They were able to sort of govern because the government can sort of carry on the basic business, but they can't pass a lot of legislation, or at least not pass it easily, especially as the Tories, for various reasons that we discover, become more and more uncooperative. There is a certain sort of oiling of the wheels of power. They have this sort of the usual channels which just allow Parliament to operate. You have things like the pairing of MPs, so that MPs can sort of take time off, and two MPs of opposing sides both take time off together, so there's no advantage or disadvantage to the voting, and for various reasons that got suspended for a while. And there are rather interesting things about the way that the Labour Party consistently lost votes, or that they had to keep MPs who were increasingly old and sick, and had come from industries where they might suffer from diseases and things that might knock bump them off earlier than a rather more comfortable Tory MP might be. I found this, you know, fascinating, and I'm probably going on about too much about it, but we also get some really nice pieces in there. There's and it's interesting what he picks. There's quite a lot of thing about Jeremy Thorpe, who's I think he was mentioned as the MP for Plymouth, I think it was, and the murder case that he was involved in, which was a very strange thing that happened in the late 70s, and there was also the there's a character called John Stonehouse who disappeared on a beach in Florida and turned up in Australia a few months later, but he had he was eventually charged with fraud, but he was still an MP for quite a long time, even after he had sort of disappeared and come back and was facing charges. And there's also a rather chilling piece. We get I can't remember exactly the MP, but we get a character who becomes more and more clear that he's a man called Airey Neave. Now, Airey Neave, first British person to escape from Colditz, was also a big supporter of Margaret Thatcher. He died at the opening of the 1979 election because he was his car was blown up by the IRA in the House of Commons car park. They used a mercury switch so that when he drove his car up the entrance ramp, it blew up the car. And we actually see in this play, and I was rather chilled by this, but you'd only be chilled by this if you know this, you actually see him saying, "Let's go and win this election." And I suddenly think, yeah, and 20 minutes later, that man was dead, which chilled me slightly. And it's that's lovely bits of detail like this, lovely bits of character detail like this. I mean, it's not a very nice thing to say, but it's really quite effective. The other thing is that it's possibly the most famous person in here, from a well-known person, is somebody who's known throughout and played by it's played by Charles Edwards, and is known throughout as Jack Weatherall, and they make quite a lot of jokes about him being sort of the son of a tailor and always carrying a thimble with him and stuff like that. Now, he later achieved fame as his real name was Bernard Weatherall. He was known as Jack because he had a sister called, well, his sister was named, he had a twin sister, and they were known as Jack and Jill, so he sort of nicknamed Jack. But he became famous as Bernard Weatherall, the Speaker of the House of Commons, and they detail something, towards the end we get a detail of a kind of a friendly arrangement that they came to, which is real, and they both talked about it at some point, between Jack Weatherall and Walter Harrison, who was the they were both the sort of the deputy chief whips. Walter Harrison's from Labour, played by Philip Glenister very well, and as I said, Jack Weatherall was the Tory deputy chief whip, and they come to an arrangement, and that is a real thing that happened. I have to say, I spent quite a lot of time coming out of this play just going on Wikipedia and looking everybody up and finding out that the character who throughout is known as Colonel was actually a man rather interestingly named Carol Mather, who was Carol as spelled as a girl's name, and just being absolutely fascinated by this. So I'm probably a bit too much of a politics junkie about this, but I think it's a good play even if you don't know the politics. So Nick, what did you think about all of this?
Nicely taking into someone who doesn't know very much about the politics of it. There's things, for me it's kind of history, although I was alive at the time. By the time I was old enough to know what was going on, Thatcher was in power. I suppose for me that was the predominant. It is also deliberately in there as kind of this kind of doom that's hanging over the whole play, is because everybody knows how it's going to end. That they're generally, the MPs are generally referred to by their constituency rather than their name, which for most people is probably not, is probably keeping it quite vague. But in the case of when they start talking about Finchley is running for the Tory leadership, I think most people knew who that was about. But from a completely different perspective of not really being an expert in the period or in the politics of that kind, it's still a very, very well worth seeing. I found it fascinating. I found it's a very, given what As you say, you know, obviously, even if you know the history of it, it's quite a different perspective to find out just how tenuous the leadership was and how hard it was to get anything done. So in that context, it makes a lot of sense to see it from the point of view of the whips, whose entire job is to just by hook or by crook get the results for the party. So it makes a lot of sense, and it's quite interesting to see it from not necessarily you very rarely see any people portrayed on stage who certainly who I recognised. I think Hezrel Tyne turns up at one point, but you know, you very rarely see the most kind of the most kind of front benchers. But yes, I thought it was very, very well performed. I mean, on the as with most people who went in the last week, because actually I think the press night's been delayed because Phil Daniels has been unavailable for family reasons. He's he plays the first Labour chief whip who is replaced who leaves his job halfway through, and he's not currently at performances, so Howard Ward from the Curious Incident cast has stepped in and doing a very good job. But yes, the performance is generally very good. There's as well as the central characters, there's a sort of pool of ensemble actors playing a hell of a lot of different MPs and background characters and giving a lot of different personalities to them. So it's also, I mean, it's in quite a frightening way, it's a very funny play. I say frightening because it's a lot of it becomes quite farcical, and what's frightening about it is that you can believe it, and that this is kind of the people who are running the country. And for all we know, you know, in 30 years' time, we could be finding out the equivalent stuff about today is, you know, just how much on a knife edge and how much it borders on farce. It's definitely worth seeing if you can get in. I mean, I think it's virtually sold out. It's one of those where I think tickets occasionally pop back up on the website, but if you can get to see it, it's very good. And yes, the design is very good. I mean, it's despite the fact that actually very little of the play happens in the houses in the but it's I ended up in there, which is a very good, really, it's you really feel part of it there. And it's it very occasionally they do show up in there for kind of the debates and the certain other events that happened in there, like things that maybe it was not designed for, like fights, like you say, two sword lengths apart, but that didn't stop some of them going for fisticuffs. But yes, despite the fact that it's not actually set there very, very much, the set is very good, and it really kind of gives you the feel of where you are and what's going on. And it's a nice contrast, I think, is you're sitting in the public face, even though it wasn't, you know, quite as public then. It wasn't on TV then. You know, you're sitting in what people think of when they think of the House of Commons, and what you're seeing is actually the kind of wheels being greased behind the scenes.
We're now going to talk about Twelfth Night, which has just opened at the Globe. This is really a revisiting of a production from several years back, starring Mark Rylance as Olivia. It's an original practices production at the Globe, which means that there are no women in it, and we have to have women playing men, which is fine when you've got somebody like Paul Chahidi playing Maria. He does it extremely well, and it's good for Mark Rylance's rather strange take on Olivia, which really comes good in the second half, I think. It does present some problems. The viola here is not, perhaps, not quite strong enough. Lots of people around me, when we were talking about it, really sort of wondered if Samuel Barnett, who played Sebastian, would have done a better job as Olivia. I seem to recall when I first saw this production, this original practice production with Mark Rylance, thinking that the Olivia wasn't too strong in that. And I think it might have enough a bit to do with the the production as much as anything else, and the way that he's told to act, rather than the way that any problems that Johnny Flynn might have had. Johnny Flynn who plays Olivia Viola. But the major thing about this cast, of course, is the actor playing Malvolio is Stephen Fry, and it is actually the reason I would not have normally revisited this production myself, but I couldn't resist the temptation of seeing Stephen Fry back on stage after about 17 years, I think it is, since he famously walked out of another play. And it's actually a lot longer than that. It's almost over 20 years since I've seen him on stage, and I only ever saw him a couple of times. And in this, he is... I thought very good. He's very relaxed, which is good. He's very comfortable in his role. Perhaps he's a bit too sympathetic as Malvolio. I don't know how people like to see their Malvolios. He's not as sexy as I personally would like to see a Malvolio, but that's purely a matter of my taste, my rather strange taste. And he's ably supported by a lot of other people who are sort of regulars. I mean, you have Colin Hurley as Sir Toby Belch, who I thought was very good. You've got James Garnon as Fabian. Now, James Garnon has been really caught the eye in the production of Anne Boleyn, where he played James I and is completely mad. And he's now sort of a regular at the Globe and is always well worth watching. And of course, the other person to mention playing Sandu Egucheek is Roger Lloyd Pack. Now, this is largely because they are transferring this and Richard III to the Apollo later. There's sort of a lot of doubling between those two productions. There's a lot of people playing roles in both. It's the same because it's the same, essentially the same company. So it was a good treat. I mean, Roger Lloyd Pack would normally be thought of as too old to play Sir Andrew Egucheek, but I thought he was very good in this. What did you think about it, Nick?
This was, for me, my first original practices production, because I never went to the Globe during the time that Mark Rylance was running it. I'd kind of been put off a bit by certain things about the way he about the original practices, and I found the way he described what they were going to do when they were first setting up their first few seasons, I found it very kind of prohibitive, and made it sound to me like it was a museum piece rather than a theatre. So it kind of put me off for several years, and I've only been there since Dominic Drongul took over. So this was my first experience of it. It's strange. It's not a production that I can kind of say is hugely problematic, but I found it very subdued, very kind of low key, and especially for this was the production that I always got the impression was sort of the key production from Rylance's tenure as artistic director, and seeing this kind of quite understated production that's kind of it's funny enough, but it's never kind of really. Really exploded for me. I kind of felt like maybe I didn't miss that much by not going there during the first decade or so of the Globe's life. Most people, it seems, I had problems with Johnny Flynn's performance. It's the voice. It's the voice, really, for me. And what surprises me is that he's done a season with Propeller, who of course do a very very naturalistic take on men playing women, and so it's surprising to see somebody with that background. And like you say, it may be that this is specifically what he was told to do, doing this kind of squeaky voice, which is kind of funny for the wrong reasons, and leaves very little room for any performance whatsoever. And I was one of the people who said, I mean, why not? If you want someone with a higher voice, I mean, Sam Bonnet does actually have a higher voice. You know, he, without sounding feminine, it's a bit of a higher voice that, you know, he could have just done the lines naturally and actually got some acting in. Like I say, he's very good, but he's Sebastian, so you know he's only on it for about a split second. Yeah, so it's things like that, and again, I think it's one of the things I have problems with original practices, because it's quite subjective. It's kind of announcing itself as knowing what it would have been like, actually it's still guesswork. It's just claiming to be a bit more authoritative than other productions, which just say they're just doing what they can and finding their way, which is pretty much how most productions at the Globe nowadays go. They kind of say, you know, well, we'll largely use the styles of the time, but we'll see what works. And I think they've found a good good kind of balance with that for most productions. So with this, there's things like I found very little interaction with the audience, which I found very surprising. Funnily enough, one of the few people to do it was Stephen Fry, who's the person who's been away from the stage for so long and who obviously hasn't acted at the Globe before. But there was very little going on between the actors and the audience, which is kind of an absolute trademark of the venue for me. I find it hard to see how you can even perform there and not bring the audience into it. It's because of the shape of the place and the atmosphere of it. So that was quite odd. But yes, there are a few very, very good performances. Like I say, I mean, I can't necessarily complain about the fact that the so-called accurate original practices are not that accurate. I mean, I've never heard of, you know, any time I've heard of the women being played in Shakespeare's day, I've always seen the word boys, which I don't think necessarily applies to any of the men play women in this. Certainly not Paul Chahidi or Mark Rylance. But you know, I'm not complaining about it because those are two of the best performances in the show. But you know, this is kind of what I mean about it's a subjective thing that's kind of perhaps being passed off as being a bit more accurate than it maybe is. But yes, it's fine. It's got its fun moments, and there's a couple of absolutely brilliant performances. I mean, for like I say, for me, Paul Chahidi was the standout. Although I liked, like you say, it's quite an unusual take on Olivia from Mark Rylance. But it's interesting. She's very to me, she was very childlike. Kind of, I mean, he's said himself, especially now that he's playing the same part 10 years on, that he feels he's a bit too old for the part. But I think the take on it still works because it she does feel like someone who's been very sheltered by this father and brother who kind of died in quick succession and is kind of lost in the world. Yes, I don't know that I like a sexy Malvolio, but I do like perhaps a more vicious Malvolio than we got from Stephen Fry. But again, I don't mind kind of seeing something done a bit differently, and I'm not surprised to see that we got a very sympathetic Malvolio from Stephen Fry. So it's not particularly a problem for me. I wouldn't want to see that in every performance, because I think the gulling of Malvolio, the kind of the torturing him in a darkened cell, becomes it becomes sad before the play itself kind of cottons on that it's a bit much. It's, you know, I'm happy enough with it. I wouldn't want to see it in every production. But yes, I mean, quite outside of this, I'm quite looking forward to, well, I'm quite happy to wait a while for my next 12th night, because there's been quite a few of them in the last couple of years. But when it does come around, I'm quite looking forward to them maybe being a decent viola, because it's been a while since I've seen one of those. And I know they exist. I know somewhere in the back of my memory I've seen really good violas, but I'm struggling to remember when the last one was.
I would slightly defend original practices in that the when Mark Rylance was there, it was always seen as an experiment. It's not seen as we know how it's done. It's saying, well, okay, let's start off with how was it done, you know. So they were really always asking a question, and it doesn't always work. And I think it actually the reason that this is held up as a good example is because it actually did work, you know, sort of worked the first time. I mean, I'm never entirely satisfied with original practices because I like to see women on stage, and although Shakespeare wrote for boys and possibly older men who could look like you know, because he often wanted sort of slightly frightful women or larger women, so there would have been specialist you know, female actors at that stage. But although he wrote for them, they do fit women. These days they fit women much better than they fit men. It will be interesting to see. Actually, Propeller are doing, I think they're touring 12th Night next year, aren't they?
So, oh, that's right. Yes, I know.
So it'll be interesting to see their take on it. But obviously,
yes,
they don't make any pretense about thing. You know, it's a man in a frock, you know, essentially.
Yes,
way they do it. So it will be interesting to see how they do it. I can't remember if I've seen them do it before. So it'll be interesting to see that take.
But also, I think it's a man in a frock. But also, I find that, I mean, compared to the Viola here, not necessarily compared to the other performances, because this is really the one that's contentious. But compared to the Viola, I find that it's a man in a frock in Propeller, but also I think that it's a lot more feminine in some way, because it's not so forced. It's just a performance. Whereas I think this is the thing, really. I felt with this that I was constantly being drawn attention to the fact of, you know, listen to my high, reedy voice, and, you know, and there's that, and, well, you know, are you going to get around to doing any performance? Well, you can't, can you? Because you're too busy, you know, you're keeping up the high voice, so you're not performing at all. Whereas I think when you don't really, when you kind of treat it very matter-of-fact, you much more quickly look past the fact of the cross-dressing and just get to the character when you're not drawing attention to it like that. Unless, like you say, unless it's being drawn attention to as a grotesque, as you know, for comic effect, which again Propeller did this year in the Henry V. You know, it's a tricky one, because it's not something that there is a single answer to, and I certainly don't have it if there is. But it is a bit kind of trial and error, and for me that didn't quite work out.
Another thing I've that was slightly perturbing me, I think it's a word, just sort of every so often, was, I don't know if you know the Blackadder series very well, and of course one of the things that made Stephen Fry you know, rather famous was in Blackadder 2, where he was an Elizabethan person. So, you know, Lord Melchett, you first get his Lord Melchett character, and of course there was the slight feeling that he might go into that at some point. And
you know what, I am sure there was a at some point.
Yeah, but there also the first episode of Blackadder 2. Steals liberally, then you keep getting when you get the Orsino and Viola scenes. I did get a slight feeling of so you're in love with your manservant, are you? and I couldn't help, you know, that couldn't help making it slightly a strange feeling for me. But I mean, generally this is good, and I think Stephen Fry's got, you know, it's quite welcome back to Stephen Fry, because I'd like to see him do a lot of other stuff. I mean, I quite like him as a person. I don't think, you know, I don't like all this National Treasure nonsense and, you know, living genius rubbish that they do about him, but he's a decent actor and a nice bloke, I think. So it's
no,
nice,
and there's, and
it.
There's certainly I think part of the thing with him being a more sympathetic Malvolio is, even if you don't, like you say, kind of buy him as a great living genius and a national treasure, there is he is somebody who has a huge amount of public warmth towards him. He's someone who, you know, people are very fond of. So that's, I think, one of the reasons I found it inevitable that he'd be a more sympathetic Malvolio, because he's and especially under the circumstances, he's somebody who people have waited a long time to see on stage. I certainly as celebrity Malvolios of recent years go, it's better than Richard Wilson's attempt a few years ago.
We're now going to talk about King Lear at the Almeida Theatre. This is Michael Attenborough's production of the play, and it stars Jonathan Pryce as King Lear, along with Ian Gelder and Clive Wood as the Earls of Kent and Gloucester, Zoe Waits and Jenny Jules as Goneril and Regan, Phoebe Fox as Cordelia, Kieran Pugh as Edmund, and Richard Goulding as Edgar. This production, I mean, I've seen so many of these now. I think it's about the 15th. I still don't know the difference between Regan and Goneril for some reason. And but this production, I thought, was good. But it left me strangely cold afterwards. I mean, I could not fault this at all. I think, you know, all the actors are good. I'm very glad to see Jenny Jules there, because she's a particularly an actress I particularly like. But I really, you know, at the end of the day, it was it was just a good production. I mean, there were almost no what I call special touches. It was, you know, everything was efficient, everything was in the right place. The only special touch, I think, was the notion that perhaps King Lear may have abused his two daughters. There are some rather passionate kisses that go on. But I just, you know, it's a horrible thing to say that about, you know, what is definitely a 4-star show, but it just, you know, I was left slightly cold. What did you think about it, Gareth?
Well, I think it's a great King Lear, actually. I obviously enjoyed it more than you, because it did move me. And I think the reason why it's probably a great King Lear is that director Michael Attenborough hasn't kind of messed with it, really. I mean, because there is no concept, because there is no sort of gimmick, I just think it's left to the play and to the story, beautifully spoken verse, and in such a way that I heard lines I don't remember, really. And it's about the eighth Lear I've seen, but I got more out of this Lear than I got out of any other. And Lear falls at the first hurdle for me, because I rarely believe that he would turn Cordelia out like that. I always think, well, you know, you're a clever guy. Why would you turn your daughter out just because you won't be sycophantic? And I always find that very hard to take. But for some reason in this production, I did kind of buy that quite early on, which helped, really. So I think it's a great production because it's simple, beautifully spoken and beautifully acted. And I agree with you. Jenny Jules is an actress I like very, very much. I just thought it was great to see her in a classical role, because I've seen her in lots of modern roles and indeed modern classics, but certainly not in Shakespeare. So that was a real treat. Clive Wood, an actor I've liked for many, many years, is going through, for me, a career renaissance. And he was one of the best Gloucesters I've ever seen. And it was great to see my favourite Geordie, Trevor Fox, do a terrific turn on the fool, really. And as for Jonathan Pryce, well, you know, he's up there with the best for me. I mean, I think he really did inhabit Lear in a way that rarely happens. I think at the end of the evening, when you sort of saw him completely exhausted and drained on the stage, you kind of realised, I think, that he'd given it all. So for me, it was a great Lear, one of the best I've seen. And I would recommend it absolutely, without hesitation, really.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that as I said, I can't fault this. I mean, I couldn't think of anything wrong with it. It just, in the end, didn't turn me on. Sorry, Web Cowgirl, carry on. What did you think?
Yes, I wish I'd felt so good about it, because I just watched a beautifully executed rendition of, you know, one of the classics of English theater, or perhaps all of theater, and it just, I just didn't care, and I never engaged, and I felt so bad about myself, because I knew I was watching a very good production of this show, but I was actually very alienated at the beginning with the disgusting quasi-French kiss thing with Lear and Goneril and Regan, that I never was able to conjure up any sympathy for Lear. And I found myself at his sort of first setback, when he's getting complained at for having too many men with him, that I was actually sympathizing with the daughters. I thought, yeah, that old man is a bunch of problems. Why do you want to put up with his crap anyway? And I really don't think that's how you're supposed to feel. But I had seen the 2007 version with Thurian, and in some ways, I doubted that I was actually really ready for another Lear. And I decidedly wasn't. I would recommend this show to people who, you know, haven't seen, you know, an A-cast production of King Lear. But I didn't see it really adding anything to the whole, you know, world of Shakespearean plays. Because part of the reason why I'm able to motivate myself to go see, you know, the same Shakespeare show over and over is because there's so many things that you can do with it. And this show just kind of, it was very straight ahead, very, you know, acting, 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 line, 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 move, move, move. And for me, it just never managed to get to the emotion, to the passion, except for Clive Wood as Gloucester, who about had me in tears, actually. I had never felt so heartbroken watching him suffer the tribulations that he got because of his mistakes. Now, he admittedly was misled. You know, I had been thinking at some point, oh, why don't they even just cut this entire subplot? Who really cares? It'd get us all out of there a bit sooner. But, you know, by the end of the show, I was just feeling so destroyed by what had happened to him. But I didn't feel like that for Lear. So I'm not sure. I feel like it was a failing of me that I never was able to connect with what was going on. And actually, it's just a little bit of a relief to hear that I wasn't the only person who was left a bit dry by it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, though, I mean, the very reason I did like it was because it wasn't, it didn't have a sort of a new spin on anything or a new concept or anything like that. It was a straight reading, but for me, that was its real attraction. Maybe I've seen too many people messing around with Shakespeare, and it was a bit refreshing to find someone who didn't.
There was a lack of Inuits on stage.
The last time they did Shakespeare at the Armada was also Michael Attenborough, I think, and that was also a terrific production, A Measure for Measure, where similarly, you know, they did a straight reading, and I got more out of Measure for Measure than I've ever got out of Measure for Measure before. It was the one with Rory Kinnear.
Yeah, that's good.
And that was great as well. So in the space, you know, the space is good for Shakespeare, I think, because you rarely see Shakespeare in a, you know, this quality Shakespeare in a venue that intimate. You know, it's a very different experience than seeing Timon of Athens in the Olivier or the Merchant of Venice in the Stratford Theatre. I mean, it's a very different experience seeing Shakespeare in small scale, and but small scale with the production values and the casting, you know, that equals all those kind of those great theatres, really. So for me, it was just the simplicity of it all that got to me. To me, it allowed the play to do the job. You know, it didn't get in the way of what I think Shakespeare was trying to say and says so beautifully, really. So there you go. But, you know, it's an individual experience, isn't it? You experience a play, and sometimes on a different night you get a different experience. Sometimes a different person gets a different experience on the same night, and that's
absolutely
the thing about going to theatre. So
I think I maybe just hadn't recovered quite from my, you know, holiday in the sun, and I wasn't ready for things to get serious. But I did feel watching that show that we have such an embarrassment of riches here. And the quality of the acting on stage was, I just couldn't believe that I could be in such a small theater seeing these, you know, A-level actors absolutely, you know, doing their very best, such quality, and for really such a reasonable price. We're fortunate to have this kind of thing available to us, and the right for this show to be, you know, as extensively sold out as it is. If you, I mean, I'm glad that you had like a really good evening, and I absolutely will accept the fact that perhaps if it had been a little further into the fall theatrical season, that I might have been in a better mental state for it, because I can't deny that it was good despite the fact that I left the theater, you know, unmoved.
We're now going to talk about Bully Boy. This is a new play by Sandy Toksvig at the newly reopened St James's Theatre. It's been completely rebuilt, but it once was the Westminster Theatre, and there's been a theatre on that site for I think about 250 years old. So in some places they are advertising themselves as the oldest theatre in London, or one of the oldest theatres in London. This play is a co-production with Roland Derngate in Northampton, where it had a rather successful run and has been pretty well reviewed. It's a play that stars Anthony Andrews and Joshua Miles as a wheelchair-bound officer in the the CBI, the Criminal Investigation Branch, I think is the of the of the military police, and a squaddie who has been involved in an incident where a young Afghan boy has been killed, but also a member of the young lad's platoon has also been killed at the same time. It goes into a lot of the ideas of sort of post-traumatic stress and how they're dealt with. Our wheelchair-bound officer was a Falklands veteran, although he didn't get his injury as a direct result of fighting in the war, although he was it happens at a different time, but is but it is sort of shortly after the war that it happens, and he is they develop a relationship. I have to say that as good as I thought this was, and as rich as the relationship between these two soldiers is, I didn't believe it for a moment. I thought the procedure was all all up the spout. It just didn't work as a procedural. But it does work as this kind of relationship, the story of the friendship, and this investigation really into the way that soldiers are treated and the way that they behave. John, what did you think about it?
I just want to pick up on a couple of things that you said in the introduction there. I did think it was very good, but isn't this originally a Nuffield Theatre Southampton production? I know it's a co-production with the Royal and Derngate, but I think it started life out in Southampton.
You may very well be right.
Patrick Sanford's
I'm just reading what it's in front of me at the moment.
And the other thing I wanted to say was I have enormous affection for the Westminster Theatre because it is the first theatre in London I ever went to as a child to see, I don't even say this, Dame Flora Robson in Rodney Acland's The Old Ladies. So it had a little bit of a resonance for me. Now, the play itself, I found instantly absorbing and enchanting. It has great impact. It has excellent dialogue. And the two principal characters are phenomenally well acted. I mean, you've already given a shout out to Anthony Andrews. But I think Joshua Miles needs some recognition as well. This young man is only just out of Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And he is a personage of great impact and fitted this part beautifully. I think partly because he has a natural Lancashire accent, and the character he plays, the squaddie, is from Burnley, and it's very unusual in London to get a northern accent so accurately and pinpointedly delivered. So since he got the pitch of that right, it seemed that the rest of his performance followed pretty naturally too. I agree with you that the procedural and the relationship between the two men as it develops and the way they sort of momentarily exchange control is a little bit circular and a little bit unnatural. I think even in the most modern divisions of the British Army, the natural respect of serving soldiers for senior officers is always maintained, and I think the suggestion that even though they go through a kind of life-saving situation, that they wouldn't become drinking mates in the way that Sandy Toksvig suggests in the latter part of this play. But that's to pick a very small nit, really. I found this very engaging, fearsomely well done. I thought the minimal set was extremely stylishly delivered. I thought that the work they had done to give Anthony Andrews a very modern wheelchair and his expertise at driving it really were a sort of tribute to the Paralympics, because that's the sort of timing of it, that it was impressively well performed and choreographed as far as that was all concerned. The play moves at a great pace. The scene changes are very slick. And for a two-hander, it's again impressively well driven forward. They both concentrate extremely hard, and I think so does the audience.
Yeah, the Anthony Andrews, I actually thought I'd missed something, and he'd actually sort of broken something because he was so good in the wheelchair. I thought I'd sort of missed a bit of news where he'd got wheelchair bound.
Why did you think it was set? Because it felt to me fairly indeterminate. I felt that she was deliberately fudging whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan. It feels modern enough to be Afghanistan, but it could easily have been either of the Gulf Wars. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, I certainly felt it was fairly up to date. I thought it was, you know, I thought it was Afghanistan because I thought it was pretty much that sort of place. I don't know if they mentioned any particular airport or the IEDs. Because Iraq has gone down so much in the sort of the public view. But it could have been set sort of. I mean, it did have the feel of being set sort of a few years ago rather than, you know, so it could have easily have been Iraq, but I did immediately think of it as Afghanistan, I have to say.
I put it in his helmet. We should say that the incident that happens in the play is that Private Eddie Clark is a member of a small platoon of soldiers out on patrol, and there's an incident where they are not completely sure whether a woman and a child who are watching them are somehow agents of the insurgents or are just natural observers of what's going on. And the woman appears to be following them with her gaze in order to give a clue to snipers which direction they might fire in, and they're afraid of her, and she's killed. I think it's not giving too much away to say that. And then the child is also suspected of holding a grenade and is dispatched in an equally summary way, and is it fair to say he's thrown down a well? I mean, it's really quite shocking when you hear it, but it comes so early.
Yes, I mean, it's right at the beginning, and it also, you know, it deals with or who exactly did it. Which is another thing, you know. It's not entirely, you're not entirely sure who did that, which member of the platoon did that, or the section.
Part of what draws in your engagement really is that you want to know, and you want to hear everybody's side of this story, which Anthony Andrews is charged with drawing out. And in fact, one of the first things that Joshua Miles says as the squad is, is this about the boy or is this about the whole thing? So you get this wonderful clue that there is a whole lot more to tease out of the story. And I think that's seeded extremely well by the plotting. So I think the things to say are the acting is impeccable. It's very stylishly delivered. It's quite exciting to go to this brand new theatre and see, you know, what almost certainly will be Olivier nominated for Best New Play, and possibly a couple of Best Actors as well. I really thought it was extremely good. And if we do pick holes in it, it's only because we need to fill out 10 minutes of chat, really. I think you would say to any friend, this is a really, really good play. Go and see it.
Yeah, I certainly think I've recommended it to a few people. Also, it's worth saying about the theatre. I mean, it was rather an interesting theatre. It's partially... Well, it's sort of... In a curve, I think, and very, very highly raked the stage or the seating.
It feels a bit like Trafalgar Studios 1 or Hampstead, doesn't it? It's a bit vertiginous because you come in at the top of the back of what looks like a circle, but in fact it's just one piece of auditorium. And I don't know where you sat, but it wasn't very full, so I just chose myself a place in about row D, which felt very comfortable because I was kind of good eye level with the actors. I think if you're in the very front row, you might get an awful lot of feet and wheelchair wheels, so kind of sit sort of in the middle if you get the opportunity to seat.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook, on the web we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.